welcome, everybody. This is Scott Cassell, the CEO and founder of the Product Stewardship Institute. I want to welcome you to our first call in our packaging call series. This is entitled Packaging and Printed Materials in the U.S. What's the problem? What are the opportunities? And what do the data say? We're very excited to be able to have this conversation with all of you today. And just so that you understand how the call will run, we do have maybe 120 people that have registered for the call, so that we have all of you on mute for now. But this is a highly participatory call, so we certainly want you to unmute your phones at the appropriate time, which will be real soon. And to do so, you push *6 on your phone. And then to get back on mute, you push *6 as well. And that would cut out some of the background noise to allow all of us to hear each other and also the presenters as well. I'm going through a presentation right now. It's the PowerPoint that we have provided. And I'm now on the second slide, which is the participants on the call. As you see, we have quite a diverse group. And you see the spread here. I don't necessarily need to go through each one, but we're very pleased at the diverse representation for all the different stakeholders. The next slide is entitled Ground Rules, and I do that with a small g and a small r, if you will. I mean, this is not a negotiation per se, but it is a discussion and a dialogue, maybe a debate. I'm sure that we're going to have different opinions. I hope that those opinions will be expressed here because we believe that that's how we can make some headway and move forward by understanding how each of us is taking a different view of these different issues. So, you know, with that, I think it's important that all of you be authorized to represent your company, agency, or organization. We don't want, you know, Scott Mao coming on the line and saying, you know, that the EPR is just the absolute worst thing in the world and he never wants to see it happen in the United States, or you know, someone that doesn't believe in EPR saying it's the greatest thing and we're all confused at which entity they represent. So, you know, this is really important that we understand where each of us is coming from and, therefore, that you're able to speak on behalf of your agency, a company, or organization. Also, you know, as with any other good discussion, you know, please ensure not only your interests are articulated, but it's important that others' interests are met as well. You know, we're on here to seek some common ground. And it's important not only to listen, but to, you know, see if we can kind of go over to what the other person is speaking about, particularly if we don't fully understand. We want to understand exactly what each of us is talking about. The third bullet here was a request by one of our participants, and I think it's a good one to always have. Listen, comments, you know, made during the call are not for attribution. We don't want them, you know, quoted out of context and so forth. This one said that, and that one said this. You know, certainly speak, you know, from your own perspective, but don't attribute any comments to others, please. And then last, we like the good faith discussions, and I did put the word negotiate in here. We're kind of negotiating of some sort to understand our viewpoints. There's nothing on the table that we're really negotiating, but we're talking about data and we want to understand each other, but, you know, do it from a place again of trying to understand the other. Okay, next slide, please. So the context for these calls, this is a technical call series. We do quite a few dialogue meetings. We've run, you know, hundreds of them, conference calls and actual, you know, very large meetings like this in person or over the phone. And this is definitely not a webinar. We're going to have a lot of interaction as much as we can in the confines of this virtual world that we're in here. It's going to be somewhat educational. We hope that you'll learn an awful lot, but we want it to be a collaborative discussion. This is not a rehash of, you know, everything that's happened, ho-hum. We want this to be moving forward. You know, it's a forum here for discussion of all the different interests, and talking about, you know, the latest information of the existing initiatives all in one space, so that we're all listening to it together but moving forward as a group. We're going to be holding 3 2-hour calls. We want them to build on each other, and at the end of this one, we'll preview the next one. At the beginning of the next one, we'll talk about what happened on this one and so forth. And as I said, we want them highly interactive and to try to get us onto a common agenda. No reinventing of the wheel as we're moving forward here. But I do recognize that there will be people in different places on the call, some that are very new to the discussions and others that have been in every discussion in the United States and Canada and are just exhausted. You're probably thankful that you can actually sit at your desk and take this call. So I'm recognizing there's a wide array of people here, and we'll have to accommodate a bunch of folks. And then we're discussing all viable strategies, both voluntary and legislative. By voluntary, I mean, let's say, you know, Whole Foods taking back number 5 plastics that are being used by Preserve, the company. We are not talking about, you know, curbside recycling programs or drop-offs as being voluntary. But it's, you know, it's the full range of initiatives here, and we hope that you appreciate that. And if you're, you know, on one side or the other, that you'll listen to the full breadth of strategies that are going to be needed in order to move forward in this issue. So the next slide, slide 5, today we're going to be focused on the problem. It's a data-focused call. We've got 5 key stakeholders that are going to talk about the state of recycling for packaging and printed materials. And we want you to end up having a greater understanding of the problem and opportunities pertaining to reduction, reuse, and recycling of the packaging and printed materials. And I'm going to be staying focused on this. It's going to be easy to move to call 2 or call 3, but there's so much to discuss on the data that I will keep bringing you back to this point, because we'll have lots more to talk about on the other 2 calls, and if there's a need to dig deeper in one of these areas, we will do so. And we can do it offline. We can have another call. We'll figure out how to do that, but I'm going to stay focused on the data and on the problem and the opportunities. You see call 2, which is the next slide. That's going to go into the goals for increasing material recovery and the barriers to achieving them. We'll have on 7 different representatives, 5 from industry, 2 from government, showing how the goals from the public and private go hand in hand, how we're going to achieve those goals, the barriers to achieving, to being successful, and really delving into these goals and looking at how are we going to, you know, where is this material going to come from? How are these groups going to achieve their different goals? And hopefully we can get some high-level consensus around the various goals. Call 3 will be relating to the strategies. So, again, call 1, problem and opportunities. Call 2, the goals and the barriers. And call 3 are the priority strategies. And there's a lot going on in the U.S. and Canada, as we know. And we'll be discussing them, the ones that float to the top. We'll see if there's any gaps in those strategies, which ones, how they relate to one another, and how we can all work together. Because, again, all these initiatives are really important. And what we're trying to do here is not control any of those. We're trying to just have a forum for the discussion of all those initiatives. So you don't have to go, if you can't, to, you know, all these various initiatives all over the place. You can figure out where you need to plug in, which ones you want to plug into, who can plug in for you, and we'll have a discussion around this. But one of the problems I think that many have seen, including us, is that there's a lot of splintered initiatives out there, and we're trying to bring some cohesion through these calls to those different efforts and seeing how they can all go together. So the objective for this call on slide 8, we hope that you'll leave with an understanding of, a good understanding of the problem and opportunities from the different perspectives, get a degree of consensus on those as well, and understand how far apart are we really, and then any gaps in data. Do we have everything we need, or are there questions around it? Is it not only that we're looking at the same thing in different ways, but are we actually missing data? And we think it's a real priority to get, and then we can figure out, you know, how much does that cost, who's going to get it. Maybe there's those out there that are already getting that data, and we can then tap into that or bring them in to discuss it some more. So the next slide will go over the agenda. on slide 9. We will next hear from Stephanie Wenock from Product Stewardship Institute, and she's going to talk about the generation and recycling of packaging and printed material, the status, trends, and highlights. We did ask folks from the U.S. EPA if they could present on their data. Unfortunately, there was no one available to present today, but I do know that there are some representatives from U.S. EPA with us on the call, and if there's any questions that we're not able to answer here, we'll certainly follow up. We're using the U.S. EPA data as a basis for our discussion. Our panel, as you see here, we've got five really great speakers, and they're going to talk for a very brief time, 3 minutes each here, and then they're going to talk a lot more in a facilitated Q&A, and that's where you're going to all come in with your questions and comments on here. We've got Scott Mao from the North Carolina Department of Environment and Natural Resources, Jen Holliday from Chittenden County Solid Waste District in Vermont, Susan Collins, who is representing the National Recycling Coalition, but who is the executive director of the Container Recycling Institute, Chaz Miller from the National Solid Waste Management Association, and then Joanne Pierce from AmeriPen. I want to thank them very much for joining us today. Continuing on slide 10, we're going to have an hour for our facilitated discussion. You'll see some of the questions that are here. We'll be coming back to them very soon. And then we'll have a wrap-up in the last 20 minutes looking at a draft issue statement that was started from discussions that we had in the U.S. EPA, year-long dialogue, looking at the problem and opportunities and the project focus, and see if we're in the same ballpark together. It's one of the last slides there that we'll touch on for a little bit. We're not going to wordsmith that at all, just getting a good discussion going, and then we'll introduce call number 2 and close the call after 2 hours. So slide 11 is just giving you options for participation. We definitely want to hear from you, and when it's time to speak, you can push star 6 to unmute your line, or here's another option. You can send Stephanie an email, and her email address is right here, and you can shoot an email over. Please, you know, have a good heading, a good subject matter, and a very concise question that she can read quickly because she's doing a number of things at once, but she'll be able to read that question on the call if that is better for you. And with that, I'm going to hand it over to Stephanie.
Great. Thanks, Scott. Can you hear me okay?
I can, yes.
Great. So as Scott mentioned, I'm just going to spend a few minutes here talking about EPA's municipal solid waste data and just try and unpack some of the numbers here that are kind of thrown around that are related to packaging and printed materials. And this will be in order to set, you know, just the background for the panelists to kind of then advance the conversation and discussion with some of their own slides and to continue on with a facilitated discussion, as Scott mentioned. So if you want to, I'll move to slide 13. Slide 13 provides a definition of the different material categories that are separately defined in EPA's MSW report. And EPA uses the term containers and packaging, which, as you can see here, is comprised of glass bottles and jars, steel packaging, which includes cans, aluminum, including cans and foil, the paper and paperboard. The subcategories are corrugated and paperboard boxes, gable top and other cartons, bags and wrapping papers. The plastic categories EPA uses are PET, HDPE, bags and wraps, wood, including wood pallets, and then a small percentage of other miscellaneous packaging. And then on the right-hand column, PSI has pulled together the relevant categories, excuse me, from the EPA municipal waste data that'll estimate, you know, what components comprise of printed materials that are relevant to this discussion. And so these are actually from EPA's non-durable goods category, if you're familiar with their information. And so the subcategories that are relevant here are the newspapers, mechanical papers, which includes directories, and other non-durable goods, which include books, magazines, office-type papers, standard mail, other commercial printing, and other non-packaging paper. And I just wanted to point out here that this does not include, you know, tissue paper, paper towels, plates, paper plates or cups, but it does include EPA's kind of catch-all term category for other non-packaging paper. So if you just move to slide 14, Using the containers and packaging category that we just looked at the definition on the previous slide, we can see here how generation and recycling have both increased over the past few decades. And we're currently, for the containers and packaging category, there's about a 48% recycling rate, which means that approximately 40 million tons are currently being disposed according to these figures. And also interesting to note here on this slide is that the generation just fell down. You can see a little bit here in 2009. It's back up again, due at least in part to the, you know, recovering economy. And so just looking now at slide 15, looking at the printed materials slide, we see a bit of a different story here in terms of the generation and recycling. So the recycling rate for printed materials, again, that kind of classification that was on the previous slides, is around 62% currently for 2010, which means that about 20 million tons are not currently being captured for recycling. We can also see here from this graph that the generation of these materials has decreased significantly since you see the peak there in around 2000, while the recycling rate has stayed relatively the same with some minor changes over the last decade or so. And in fact, the actual ton of recycling went down slightly in the printed materials category in 2005 to 2010. However, as you can see, because generation has decreased also, the recycling rate increased from about 46% in 2005 to about 62%, as I mentioned, which is currently in 2010. So as you can see here, the recycling rate for printed materials in particular is significantly impacted by the amount of materials available or generated. So if you just want to move to slide 16 now, it's kind of just a recap of some of these numbers. The containers and packaging is about 48.3%, and the printed materials recycling rate currently around 62%. And if you kind of put that together, an overall recycling rate for packaging and printed materials, which is the focus of this call in terms of the data, is around 52%. Then you look at the first bullet, shows that these materials, according to the EPA data, make up about 42% of the municipal solid waste stream, and that it's important to note that this includes residential but also commercial waste, which is something that I'll touch upon in a couple slides further down. But if you want to move now to slide 17, slide 17 just shows a breakdown of the material categories that make up what we're calling packaging and printed materials. And so you can see that with paper, paperboard, and printed materials together, it makes up nearly two-thirds of all the category of packaging and printed materials, which is definitely significant, as you can see as we go to the next slide, slide 18, which shows a kind of a side-by-side comparison of each of the materials type recycling rates along with the portion of total packaging and printed materials it makes up. So, for example, paper and paperboard makes up around 36% of total packaging and printed materials and has a high recycling rate of around 71%, according to EPA data. So as you can see kind of over to the right-hand side, the overall 52% recycling rate, once you start to, you know, unpack this data a little more, you can see that, the certain type material categories like paper and paperboard or printed materials are bringing up the average there on the 52%, while to a slightly lesser extent, the plastic and glass recycling rates are bringing down the average according to the data that we see here. So if you move to slide 19, it's just the same information as the previous slide, just, you know, in words to provide another way to look at the numbers here. I'll just move on to slide 20 now. And we revisit, we revisit the fact that the EPA MSW data is not just focused on the residential sector, but includes generation recycling occurs in the commercial sector as well. And although no further breakdown of this kind of commercial residential breakdown is provided in the EPA data, it can be estimated at about 40 to 60% split between residential and commercial. And this is also kind of another interesting component of the data, especially when examining recycling rates for the specific materials, as was seen on the previous slide. You know, so something like corrugated cardboard that's recycled at high rates in the commercial sector would certainly have an influence on the data of the overall recycling rate that's captured for residential and commercial. Also, the first bullet here on this slide shows that while EPA estimates around 250 million tons of municipal solid waste generated in 2010, some believe that there's really no kind of most accurate estimate out there, and so that we have to kind of move along and use the best data that we have available, but just also recognizing the current potential limitations in the data, and I'm sure that's something that we'll be talking about later on in this call. So if you move to slide 21, it's just a brief summary. Can you hear me okay? I hear some background noise. Can everyone hear me okay? Scott?
I can hear you fine.
Okay. Thanks, Chad. Confirmation. Okay. It was just maybe a fluke. I'll just keep going on slide 21 here. It summarizes the inconsistencies that we see between or among the residential and commercial sectors. And again, this is just a really high-level brief overview, but we see in terms of single family that there's great developed infrastructure for curbside recycling, but that the volume of materials collected is under the needs improvement category still. There's also collection in many rural areas. There's a significant challenge for many local governments to implement single family collection in those areas. Also, we have under the needs improvement category is recycling under multifamily residential scenarios. On the right-hand side now, under the commercial sector, we see many successes of recycling within larger scale businesses and institutions, where not only is there typically higher volume of materials to collect, but also a cleaner stream of quality materials that makes recycling more economical. At the same time, we see some smaller businesses and institutions have challenges along with recycling at events, public spaces, streetscapes, or other away-from-home sources. And those are certainly areas that I think we can all agree need improvement. The next slide, if you just move to slide 22, provides a quick overview of the beverage container deposit laws in the United States. There are 10. As you can see here, while beverage containers account for about 18% of the packaging waste nationally, individual states with deposit laws, it's an estimated target between 2 and 4% of the state's overall municipal solid waste. According to the EPA data, beverage containers have about a 29% recycling rate by weight, and this recycling rate is slightly higher, as you can see, if you have the rates by unit. When we look at the second bullet here, the return rates for beverage containers in the 10 states with deposit laws have a range of return rates from 61 to 96%. And it's important to note here that the laws are not all the same, and especially in what they cover in terms of different types of beverage containers. Some may cover, you know, alcoholic beverages or juice or water, and some may not. And so with that, that's just a really kind of high-level overview of the data, and we'll be taking questions, comments on this a bit later on. But for now, I'm going to turn it back over to Scott.
Great. Thank you, Stephanie. The reason I didn't respond before was because I was on mute. I was trying to listen to myself and keeping myself on background, but nice job. So I just wanted to discuss slide 23 in terms of who pays now. I'm not going to go over this in a large extent. I'm starting to hear a little bit of feedback.
Yes, Chad, I'm hearing background. I'm hearing almost an echo now on your side.
Okay. So I'm hearing a little bit of background, which may mean that I'm on speakerphone. But there's multiple models for who pays. I'm not going to go into this. And I was the waste policy director in Massachusetts for 7 years. And I know the mismatch of how funding occurs in Massachusetts, and it looks completely different in other regions of the country. But you see there's commercial accounts, there's multifamily housing, public space management of waste and recycling, and then single family as well. And there's a mix of fees, direct subscription, withholder, and taxes. So with that, I'm going to now go to the panel discussion.
We hear from Scott now, and then we'll hear from Jen Holliday, Susan Collins, Jazz Miller, and Joanne Pierce. And if you follow along with the slide, Scott gets to start off with the famous rainbow slide on slide 26. Scott?
Okay, greetings. Hello, can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes.
Okay, thank
yes,
you.
Yes, can hear you.
Well, again, greetings, everybody, and many thanks to Scott and Stephanie for pulling the call together and the overall discussion. I think it's really fruitful for us to keep these dialogues ongoing and try to find our way forward. I'm hearing a large model. Okay, background noise is gone. Okay, good. All right, so I'm going to try to just fly through a few comments here. I'm going to try to make a quick case study from a couple of data and observational perspectives that we are far from optimizing the recovery of packaging materials in the U.S. And as one sort of main point along those lines is this rainbow chart, which you see here as a sort of graphical representation of where we stand in the recovery of various packaging materials. So this chart was produced as part of an extensive amount of committee work within the AmeriPen organization to help identify opportunities for increasing packaging recovery. And it's based on a lot of the EPA data that Stephanie just showed earlier, but also some industry data as well. And I think it's just a good representation of the room for improvement, I would call it, in the recovery of packaging material in the U.S. Have a long way to go all the way up the arc of these pieces of the rainbow to recover more and more material. So I just want to get into one real kind of wonky point, if you will, about the data, and it's one that Stephanie sort of referred to, and that is the role of corrugated cardboard in our discussion. So if you look at the AF&PA data, if you look at the EPA data, you know, obviously OCC is, or corrugated cardboard, is a huge success story when it comes to recycling and the recycling of packaging materials. The AF&PA reported 29 million tons of recovered OCC in their last report. So that really skews the data in many ways from the standpoint that most of the stuff is generated in commercial settings. It's a widely recycled material, has been for years, and it really pushes up the recovery rate at the volume that it's generated in a major way. So if you look at it from other perspectives, and if you look at the EPA data in particular, for non-corrugated paper containers and packaging, the recovery rate is only 25%. So if you just back OCC out of the discussion, you see that other paper packaging materials are recycled at a rate similar to, say, plastic bottles. So details really matter in this discussion. Of course, we also know there are other sources of data that we can readily look at, and they were referred to by Stephanie as well, and we all know what they are. Data generated by the American Chemistry Council, NAPCOR, the Aluminum Association, AF&PA. These are commodity trade associations that year in, year out, give us data to track the performance of recycling for their materials. And so they're obviously trying to share that information with the public, share that information with professionals, and show that they have ways to go when it comes to the recovery of their own materials. Many of these organizations are working very hard on recovery initiatives, and in general they are articulating, and many of them vociferously so, that their material still needs to be recovered at a higher rate. I just want to also just quickly touch on the point that Stephanie also made, which is that gap in recovery rates or recycling rates for beverage containers in the deposit versus non-deposit states. So if we're going to look for, again, a set of indicators as to where we stand in the recovery of packaging materials, that's a very good one. We can just see that we are far from optimized in the 40 states that don't have deposit legislation. And I would say we're not optimized in the deposit states either, if we're only at about a two-thirds recycling rate. I just want to share a little bit of information from the perspective of North Carolina. We also have pretty strong indication of the under-recovery of packaging materials from local government data that we collect here and from the actions of communities as they now modernize their programs. We use a couple benchmarks to kind of think through where we stand with residential recovery in North Carolina. First, we believe that the average household generates around 750 or maybe 800 pounds of recyclable materials per year. Probably about 60% of that or a little bit more is going to be packaging-type materials. If a program is performing very well, we with this curbside program, we find that they are recovering about 400 pounds of material per household served in a curbside program. So that to us is a very key benchmark. And we find that most communities in North Carolina, even those with very long-standing curbside programs, don't achieve that baseline benchmark. Now, many are starting to achieve that benchmark by the application of carts, using carts instead of bins in curbside collection programs. And we see when those are implemented and when those are deployed that carts help generate, on average, a 30%, and sometimes much higher, recycling rate in communities and curbside communities. So that is an indication to us that that packaging material was always there and that it was under-recovered. And for those communities that haven't implemented carts, that material is still there and under-recovered. And we even find that those communities that put carts in place don't necessarily always achieve a 400-pound per household recovery rate. So we see, again, an indicator that packaging is under-recovered. And one other point we pay attention to in North Carolina is, you know, how well are communities doing in adding materials to their collection mix, things like cartons or aseptic containers or non-bottle plastics. The minority of programs in North Carolina have implemented those kinds of collection formats. So we also see that as an indicator that for many packaging types, there's an under-recovered situation. And then I also want to just talk about away from home. You know, we are working very hard in North Carolina, as are many states and many communities, to close the gap in the away from home infrastructure. But I think this is one where we don't have a lot of data, but I think I would appeal to everyone to think through and think about and observe what they see as they go about, you know, daily life at sports venues, parks, recreation facilities, airports, those kinds of facilities. I think we all understand very, very keenly that infrastructure is very underdeveloped, and so any packaging generated in that sector is also under-recovered. A couple more points, and then I'll hand it back over to Scott. One is that the overall data that Stephanie shared is really important, and it gives us this national picture. But what it kind of hides is that there are real key regional variations in that data. You're going to have mature recycling systems on the Pacific Coast and then the Northeast really pull up the national average, and you're going to see, you know, if you looked at the data very closely and it could regionalize it, that the Southeast, the Midwest to a large degree, and the Mountain West are all places where, and the Southwest, I would say, to some degree, are all places where there is truly an under-recovery of packaging, and it's kind of hidden by that national data. And finally, let me just say that we definitely have data gaps in this whole discussion, and that's really critical. Two of them that come to mind is that we really don't have any authoritative analysis on the volume of packaging material available in any given household. I mentioned earlier that we think there's about 750 pounds per household served. That's a quick and dirty analysis, but we've searched for it, but we can't find any other authoritative source to tell us if that's true. And there's also no authoritative data or analysis on the breakdown of residential versus non-residential sources of generation of packaging. For example, you know, how many glass bottles are generated at home versus bars and restaurants? I don't think anybody has that kind of data, and it's a piece of data that keeps us, you know, that kind of holds us back in this packaging discussion. But regardless of those kinds of data gaps, I think we have very strong indications that the recovery of packaging materials is far from optimized in the U.S. and that we have a lot of work to do. So with that, I'll turn it back over to Scott.
Great. Thank you very much, Scott. We'll now hear from Jen Holliday from Chittenden County, Vermont. Jen? Jen, you need to unmute. Push *6.
Can you hear me now?
I can. Hello? Yes. Thank you.
Thanks. I'm going to give the perspective from the local government, which is essentially legally charged with providing the services, the waste reduction programs and services in the United States. So my first slide is the challenges for local government in providing these services and in achieving high recycling rates. So this is not a comprehensive list. Each local government is a little bit different in how they function, and that's really adds to the complexity of this conversation to keep in mind. So in general, these are challenges we all face on one level or another. Money or lack of money is the underlying issue for many of the other challenges, and I won't go into specifics. Again, we're all unique when it comes to funding, depending on how we're structured and how our constituency is. Solid waste programs are not always the priority for some local governments. Lack of convenient infrastructure is a challenge for many. Often it's related to funding. Our systems tend to be reactive and not proactive because we have no influence in design and recyclability of packaging and printed material that's made, marketed, and consumed. We all have different types of recyclables that we collect in different systems that collect these materials. So when you pass through geographic boundaries, it makes a challenge for education to the consumer. It can be challenging or in many cases not even feasible for local government to require recycling or impose other mandates to improve rates. There are unique challenges from multifamily recycling and away from home recycling in events, which Scott talked about a bit. Some of us see high population turnover, which makes education an ongoing challenge and expense. At CSWD, we have an estimated 25% annual turnover rate for our residents each year. In some areas, there's no incentive to recycle because of the low tip fees at landfills and incinerators. Essentially, it's just really inexpensive to just throw it away. And recycling is at the same rate. There's a lack of data because it's expensive to acquire, and even when we do have data, it's not consistent from one region to the next for comparison. And Scott Mao again talked somewhat about the data gaps that we all have. And the last challenge that I've listed are markets which fluctuate or are non-existent for some materials. On the next slide is just a list of some of the tools that can be used by local and state government that are currently used to achieve greater recycling rates in the United States. Again, this isn't a comprehensive list, but these are all the tools that we've implemented at Chittenden Solid Waste District in order to achieve higher recycling rates. Next slide, the way that we obtain some of our data in order to measure our recycling rates is we do periodic waste composition studies where we analyze what is actually going into the trash. And with that information combined with what is recycled in our county, that gives us our recycling recovery rate. And this is a photograph of us going through looking at the trash and obtaining that data. Next slide is, with that data, we estimated that in FY11, we had an overall recovery rate for recyclables of 68.6%, which, although we're achieving a higher rate than the national average, presumably because we're using some of those tools that were on the previous slide, in our view, the number indicates our system is still underperforming. In addition, it's really important not to just look at these recovery rates, but it's also it's really important to look at the larger picture, which includes materials that are not being recycled at all in a community. And that brings me to my last slide. If you look at the larger picture, what this chart shows is the composition of all the material at CSWD that's currently being landfilled in was landfilled in FY11. And so note that 14% of what's going in the trash is our mandatory curbside recyclables that are collected. And that's recyclables that never made it to the curb. I just want to clarify. So it's curbside recyclables that people are throwing into the trash rather than in the blue bin that goes to the curb. However, these are just the mandatory recyclables. These are not all packaging and printed material, and I think it's important to really note that because materials like milk cartons and juice cartons, styrofoam, film plastic, materials that either universally can't be recycled throughout the United States or maybe aren't recycled in the case of, say, milk cartons, they're just not recycled in our jurisdiction. those materials are going into what's shown on this chart as the MSW residue. So when you're looking, so as we have this discussion, it's not only important to talk about the recycling, but it's also important to talk about the packaging and printed material that's either universally not recyclable or limited because of lack of markets in that region. So that's it for my presentation.
Great. Thank you very much, Jen. And I hear we got a squeaky chair somewhere, but I appreciate that. And we're now going to hear from Susan Collins, representing the National Recycling Coalition. Susan?
There we go. I unmuted. Hello, and thank you, Scott. I have a couple of slides here and then a number of additional comments. So I'll start with the slide on packaging and printed paper categories in Ontario, Canada. We pulled this this list together to give you all an indication of the way that the packaging categories are considered once they're done being used, as opposed to the US EPA data, which breaks them down by paper and plastics and aluminum, et cetera. When they end up going through a MRF and have to be broken down into groups that can be recycled in a certain way, the categories grow quite a bit. Instead of 7 or 8 categories, now here we see 22 categories of materials because of the way that materials are combined or manufactured to become packaging or printed paper. So obviously, packaging isn't monolithic. There are very, very different types of materials. Even within broad material types like paper, it breaks down into very different material types that are recycled separately. The same, of course, is true for plastic. You can't, in most cases, mix the plastic resin types together and recycle them that way. And certainly, regardless of what all these material types say and what the percentages are in the waste stream of the different material types, you certainly can't make an aluminum can out of newspaper, for example. So sometimes we think about these material types and try to hit really high targets, but every single individual material type has their own target for their own material, even if it's a very small part of the waste stream. These categories also show us, we've got the prices here in parentheses, and I know this is hard to read, so the next slide is a little easier. The cost to recycle is extremely different from one material type to another. First, I want to explain a little bit about how this cost to recycle information is gathered. It includes all of the collection costs, all of the collection costs, all of the processing costs, and then subtracts out the material revenue when the material is sold from the MRF to market. So it is a net cost per ton, and that's in the header of this slide, net cost per ton. So it includes the full cost of collection and processing minus the amount that the material is sold for. So you can see the cheapest material on here is the very first one, newsprint, at a net cost per ton of $19. And the most expensive one is polystyrene at a net cost per ton of over $2,200. And the point that I wanted to make here is just that the different materials have very, very different costs of recycling. Moving on to the next slide, it's just another way to show the same information that's a little more graphical so that people can see the I've pulled out just certain categories of materials and put them here on a graph. You can see that aluminum is a material type that actually, in most systems, yields more revenue than it costs to recycle, and then everything else has a cost of recycling. Some other general points that I want to hit on as we discuss the data. Going back to the very beginning of the presentation that Stephanie gave, where we talked about the EPA estimate, there's also BioCycle State of Garbage, the report that they've done annually in conjunction with Columbia University. And there's a huge difference between the EPA estimate of the total municipal solid waste in the U.S. of 250 million tons versus the BioCycle and Columbia University estimate of 400 million tons. So I'll repeat that. 250 million tons versus 400 million tons. So when we talk about data gaps, that is the number one biggest data gap that we have. We still don't even know the gross number of what's out there. And that means that all of the information that we're presenting on packaging and printed materials might be off by quite a bit, by like 40%. Another thing that I want to bring up, a data issue for packaging that most people don't think of, is the issue of primary packaging versus secondary packaging versus tertiary packaging. It is common for us to think of the packaging materials that we use in our homes as consumers, like the cereal box or the aluminum can for a beverage, but we don't think about the box that was the materials were delivered to a grocery store in, that cardboard box, and we don't think about the wooden pallet that the materials were delivered to the grocery store on, or the shrink wrap that goes around the materials that are delivered on a pallet. So when we're looking at the US EPA data, it's not just the stuff that goes into our households, it's not just the stuff that goes into our offices, it's primary packaging, it's secondary packaging, it's tertiary packaging. So we have to sort of think bigger when we're looking at this data set. Another major point about this data set is that there's a huge difference between just packaging versus packaging and printed paper. So packaging is about, using EPA data, about 77 million tons in the U.S. And when you add in printed paper, that adds in another 30 million tons for a total of 107 million tons. Also, Scott Mao certainly touched on this. We have really uneven recovery rates now. Another way to look at some of the information here is that overall packaging, about 50% of packaging is paper and paperboard, and the other 50% of packaging is other material types. The half of packaging that is paper and paperboard has a 75% recovery rate. All of the other material types have a 22% recovery rate. So we have a lot of work to do on the other material types. Also, the recycling rates are extremely uneven from the different sources, with a whole bunch of the corrugated cardboard being collected from places like grocery stores or other retail outlets that acquire cardboard in huge quantities and have on-site balers. There was a slide on beverage containers and deposit states. I want to correct a couple of items on that slide. The lowest recycling rate in beverage container deposit states is 61%, so the range is 61% to 96%. And Scott Mao referred to that one as well, that we're very uneven in our recovery rates of beverage containers, with the average recovery rate in non-deposit states being about 35%. Also on the beverage container slide, there was a reference to the percentage of beverage containers by weight in the overall packaging stream, and according to the US EPA data, it should be 5.6%. A state like Maine includes nearly all of the beverage types in their beverage container deposit program, so they're addressing over 5% of the waste stream, but another state that only addresses carbonated beverages would be addressing a lower percentage of those materials. And the last couple of points that I want to make is that these recycling rates that we're using from US EPA also include contamination. So the materials that are, it really represents a collection rate, not a recycling rate. When these materials are collected, if they have significant percentages of contamination, that means that the ultimate amount that goes back to a manufacturer to be turned into a new product is quite a bit less than what we're seeing in these numbers. The recycling rates also include a variety of uses. So some of them are closed-loop recycling, like paper back into other paper products, but some of them include downcycling, like glass that's used for aggregate. And these different uses have very different implications in terms of greenhouse gas reduction, toxic reduction, and energy reduction. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Scott.
Thank you, Susan. I got a question from Paul Gardner just on one of your slides, 34. Quick question. On the cost per ton in Ontario, is that in Canadian dollars per metric ton or U.S. dollars per short ton?
At the time that I did this, it is in Canadian dollars per metric ton, and I made the conversion at that time, and it's not very different. I know the exchange rate has changed recently, Also, these are numbers for calendar year 2010. So please don't take any of this as gospel. As other people have alluded, markets fluctuate. So all of the scrap values would be changing, and all of these numbers would be changing, you know, pretty much from month to month. But these are the published numbers for 2010. They are Canadian dollars for Canadian metric tons.
Great. Thank you very much. Okay, we're now going to move to Chaz Miller, and Chaz is with the National Solid Waste Management Association. Chaz?
Thank you, Scott, and I appreciate the opportunity to participate in this webinar. It's a very important subject, how we can increase recycling in this country. We've certainly gone a long way since my beginning days at EPA, when a long time ago to where we are now. But it's also important to take a look at some myths that are permeating the debate, because bad laws are based on myths, not on facts. And I'm going to focus on three myths. Start with recycling is stagnant, which I hear a lot of. Well, based on EPA data, recycling increased in the last decade for products by 22.5% in tonnage, for packaging by 26.4% in tonnage, and by printed paper in 7.3%. And while that's a smaller percentage increase, we're actually doing, as has been noticed, with a much smaller base of printed paper now available with the replacement of paper communications by electronic media. We're now doing more from less, which I think is significant in and of itself. But we need to ask, you know, we can always improve, and we always should improve recycling. But we need to avoid a one-size-fits-all approach for materials. And we need to make sure that the cure fits the disease and isn't just sort of the what somebody thinks is going to work. We need to focus on those areas where recycling is struggling. And clearly, as a number of people have mentioned, multifamily housing and multi-tenant commercial buildings are showing very weak recycling returns. And we've seen some interesting legislation. In particular, California and now Maryland have passed laws requiring recycling in California, both multifamily and commercial, in Maryland in multifamily housing. And I think this helps in one sense, because it now means that tenants no longer have the excuse that they did not have the opportunity to recycle. They now will have all those collection bins, both in their apartments and in the facility itself. But we still don't know how to motivate them to participate in recycling. We know how to motivate single-family homeowners to participate in recycling. We still have not figured out yet how to motivate multifamily residents to recycle. And the same with tenants in multi-tenant commercial buildings. Now, we've heard that the recycling infrastructure is strictly local government, and I hear this time and time again. Well, yes and no. RCRA is very clear that state and local governments have final authority over municipal solid waste. But nowhere in RCRA or any state law are local governments required to be the service provider. Are they required to do the collection? Are they required to do the processing? Are they required to do, in the case of disposal, the actual disposal? In many, many cases, they simply rely on free market, on private sector businesses as their partners to collect and process these materials. I think that's a very important point. While local governments have, as they should have, the authority, they aren't necessarily the ones who carry out the task. We know, for instance, that in terms of recycling collection trucks, both residential and commercial, about 80% are privately owned. And we know that about two-thirds of the residential-style MRFs are privately owned. And if you look at the capacity of those privately owned MRFs, it's greater than two-thirds the capacity for a very simple reason. A private recycling company, when they're building a MRF, is going to look at a region, not at a city, not at a county. They're going to be looking at the entire potential recyclable waste stream, residential and commercial accounts, and not just residential. And they're going to be making that investment, and they're going to be risking their money in doing that, and in the hope and in the speculation that this will be a profitable enterprise for them to do. And this leads also to a question that was covered partially in one of Scott's slides, and it has to do how we pay for recycling in this country. Do taxes pay for recycling? Well, as Scott noted, a great majority of commercial and multifamily housing collection, whether it's solid waste or recycling, is simply paid by the building owner to their contract hauler. That is not tax money. That is simply a contractual arrangement. Single-family residential payments vary widely across the country. We know, based on talking to people in the industry and actually people outside the industry who track this, the use of taxes to pay for residential services is highest in the Northeast. And it's also actually somewhat high in the South, especially if you take Florida out of the equation. Those are areas that like to use taxes, but by no means exclusively, to pay for these services. As you go west, the amount of tax-based services decrease more and more. You show a higher use of fees, or you show a higher use of franchise or contract payments, none of which are taxes. So this leaves us sort of with the reality that the idea that the cost to manage packaging waste falls largely on the government is simply wrong. The cost to manage all kinds of waste, the cost to manage all recyclables, falls on consumers and generators. We simply pay in different ways for different products. But to say that this is all taxes, to say this is all government, is simply wrong. And that could have some unfortunate impacts on the debate itself. And one last thought I'd bring up. We seem to have sacrificed source reduction, and we're only caring about recycling. And we seem to have made the decision that a package or a product that is a much lighter environmental footprint but may well be harder to recycle carries a stigma because of that harder to recycle. And I question if that's a good policy, especially if we truly believe in the hierarchy for solid waste management. And actually, Scott, for that, I'll cut it off. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you very much, Chaz. And we're going to hear from now Joanne Pierce from AmeriPen. Joanne?
Thank you, Scott. AmeriPen had a project objective of increasing the recovery of packaging materials as one of our three primary goals. We established a team that was led by Jeff Myers of the Coca-Cola Company and Elizabeth Comer of Tetra Pak. And there are many people who are attending this call who have been very active members and working very hard along with Jeff and Elizabeth to achieve the results that have been presented just a couple weeks ago at our annual members meeting. What I'm going to review today is one of the results of one of the working teams that was assigned a project to determine data. Many of the previous speakers have mentioned the fact that we just don't have the data available. And, of course, we discovered the same when we embarked on this program to increase recovery of packaging. So with that as an objective, if you go to slide 42, we created a knowledge map. And this knowledge map is an interactive web-based mapping tool that houses fact-based information to support packaging material recovery. All information contained within this knowledge map is linked to source documents that are housed in AmeriPen's online project management database. Linking to these documents within this system protects the source documents and also prevents broken links when online sources are used. The recovery work teams use this knowledge map to develop, support, and reach other recommendations to further their work. If you look through that slide, there's a great deal of information, and what I was just trying to present here is the scope and breadth of the data that is available within this web-based program. If you go to slide 43, this gives you a view. I don't want to call it a screenshot, but if you look at the background slide where you see a table that's outlined in red, that is almost a screenshot of what this knowledge map looks like. This was established. We established a packaging material list. So if you read down the left-hand side of that column, you would see aluminum and glass. And then we established the common information metrics, which is across the top, being quality, quantity, participation, environmental attributes, financial, and the summary profile. The summary profile tab is really probably the most important tab in that it drills down and looks at all of those various attributes in those boxes to make conclusions about that particular material so that we can use that summary profile to give us clues and directions for future work. This work was shared with experts and subject matter experts in the packaging areas to help us populate this knowledge map. And we've also had this knowledge map peer-reviewed outside of our organization. And our next step, this was just presented. This is, I would say, hot off the press. We presented this to our membership at the end of June at our annual members meeting. And our next step with this database will be to determine how we're going to distribute communicate the availability of this information. And I think with that, Scott, I'll turn it back to you.
Great. Thank you very much, Joanne. So I want to thank all the speakers for the presentations here. Joanne, sorry about the slide. I guess when we put it into the PDF, the boxes went one on top of another. I know that when you do this in a slideshow presentation, they kind of flow very nicely. So for those that are on the call, you actually can see each of these boxes separately, and we can send you that slide if you're interested. I also want to thank Susan Collins and Kevin Dietley from Kevin's from Northbridge Environmental for his help and Susan's help in terms of the background data that we presented. We spent a lot of time in some of these slides, and hopefully those of you on the call will continue to send in your questions. So right now is the time when we're going to open it up to questions, and I got a couple that have come in already, and as you see, this next slide again shows you the two ways. You can push *6 on your phone and just speak your question, which I think is great. We can get different voices in on the discussion. Or you can send an email over to Stephanie, and she's shooting them over to me, and I can read the questions to you here. You might want to look back on slide 21, which has in it the successes and the areas that needs improvement. And then slide 10 has some of the questions that we're hopefully going to address here. So with that, I guess I wanted to start off with one question myself. And I think Chaz provocatively raised a question here, and I'd like to follow up on it, and particularly for our government speakers on the call, but really for all of you. Chaz said the burden isn't really, and I don't know, Chaz, I'm sorry if I'm paraphrasing here incorrectly, but that there's kind of a perception that the burden here is on government and that there's a lot of taxes the taxpayers are paying, but in reality that may not be as it may seem. That there are fees, there's other ways of paying for these programs, there's commercial customers and direct one-on-one and so forth, so it may not always be from the taxpayer. Scott, Mao, and Jen, why don't we start with you, Scott, first, then Jen, and then I'll go to the other panelists and get your reaction to that.
Thanks, Scott. I have a few things I kind of just want to touch on with Chaz's slides, and he raises some excellent point. One thing I want to touch on quickly is the idea of the stagnant recovery. I did a little bit of homework, before the call and looked at a number of data sources. Chaz is exactly right. Packaging and recycling is up, so there is a positive trend. But if you look really closely at the data, and if you especially overlay the AF&PA data with the EPA data, you find that 7.8 million tons of packaging recovery in the last 10 years or from 2000 to 2010, about 75% of it is corrugated cardboard. So again, this is another instance of which corrugated cardboard recycling really skews the data, and that big increase in packaging recovery really has come mostly from that recovery of corrugated cardboard. Secondly, if you look at the EPA data at the per capita recycling rates that are posted in the Waste Characterization Report, you can see about a 12% increase over that time frame that Chaz put up there. So 12% from 2000 to 2010, which is a nice growth number. But if you think about it, that's just a little bit over 1% growth rate per year in packaging recovery. So I don't know that makes a case that we're stagnated or not stagnated, but to me that's a very low growth rate. And then, you know, Chad has made some good points about the ownership of, you know, the key infrastructure tools in the system, the collection trucks, and that kind of thing. Again, I did some quick analysis of our data in North Carolina, and in North Carolina, about 60% of our curbside programs that are run and financed by, or that are financed by, local governments are contracted to private haulers. So it stands to reason that a great deal of the fleet that's owned to serve households in North Carolina are owned by the private haulers. And that's a standard practice for communities to contract out to private haulers, just as they also turn their materials over to private MRFs. Almost every major MRF in North Carolina is a private MRF. So a lot of residential material, the vast majority of it goes through a private MRF. However, the key point is that the recovery of that material is still financed by local governments. And we can make a fine distinction between what's a tax and what's a fee, but it really doesn't matter. It comes from the it comes from a government board making the decision to place a financing mechanism upon their citizens and their residents to make that collection happen. I certainly recognize that there are other sources of material where there's business-to-business relationships between generators and haulers, and clearly that's, you know, that's happening across the board, and there's a lot of ownership of infrastructure by private haulers to serve business generators of packaging material. However, I think if you look really closely, especially in some states, and I can say that in North Carolina, you know, that material doesn't really get recovered at high rates unless there's also a government action. So, for example, in our state, many communities have passed cardboard disposal bans. I would dare say that commercial generators would not be recycling corrugated at the high rate that they are in North Carolina if those local laws were not in place, because they would have to pay a fee to a hauler to recycle the material, and most would be unlikely to do so. So it's a real key thing to think about what Chaz has presented and think about, you know, the other perspectives here, that indeed most of that infrastructure is financed by local governments, whether through fees or taxes, it's still financed by those decision makers.
Okay, so Scott, you've raised a number of issues here, and Chaz, let me offer you the opportunity to respond.
Well, corrugated containers are 39% of packaging, so they should be leading the way and carrying the burden. As for these programs in North Carolina be financed by local government, in the first place, it's not the local government's money. It's money that belongs to taxpayers, and it's money that belongs to fee payers. Local government is simply the conduit using taxes. And fees are not a tax. Fees are just something somebody pays. Now, does that mean, therefore, they're financing the acquisition of the trucks? You can make that argument, but only if those trucks are exclusively used for those accounts, and even less so if those MRFs are exclusively used for those accounts. MRFs tend to be built to serve regional areas, to serve both private, to serve both residential and commercial accounts. And the fact that some of those MRFs may be getting stuff that may be paid by taxes does not translate into a publicly financed system. I'd also argue on OCC that you're going to run into differences in why this stuff is being collected. And, of course, in some parts of the country, that bans or other mechanisms have stimulated recovery. But the reality for OCC in particular, it's the sheer value of the material stimulates its collection. Or to put it differently, if there's no good reason to recycle OCC, to recycle old corrugated boxes, why do recyclers in New York City have a problem with people stealing those boxes from legitimate accounts and people stealing those boxes and selling them on their own? They would not be stealing them if there was no value involved in the boxes.
Okay. Let me open it up to others that are on the panel for any response to any of the things that have been just discussed.
Scott, this is Jen. I'd like to just respond from our perspective as a local government. This just really, really gives us that evidence that this is a very complex system that we have. I think that it's really overgeneralizing that taxpayers are paying for this or aren't paying it. In some cases, they certainly are. In other cases, they aren't. And, you know, in terms of infrastructure, I mean, infrastructure is not just curbside collection, there's a lot that's involved that local government is mandated to do, and waste reduction and minimization is one of those things. And you could argue that the haulers are not really mandated to do that, but it's local government. It does fall on local government, and with that, we do implement education programs. We also provide tools like carts and grants that will maximize recovery. And those all cost money. If we were just had a system where it was privately operated and run and up to the users of the system to pay for it, I think our recovery rates would be much lower. So I think we have to look at the whole picture here and not just the services that are provided at curbside.
Okay, let me go to a couple of questions that are coming in from some of the those that are in our audience here. I'm going to be speaking them through. It's hard to kind of loop them, see if they're in the right flow here, but this is from Kevin Dietley from Northbridge Environmental, and he is pointing to slide 15. And if we can go to slide 15, he says, on slide 15, that printed paper generation drops 30% in 10 years, but tons recycled are virtually unchanged over that time. What would account for the fact that recycling tonnage didn't also drop? Is it the addition of junk mail and increased capture rates due to single stream, et cetera? I don't know if any of you have a venture, any response to Kevin's comment.
I'll venture a response. I think it's clearly in the last decade you've seen, for better or worse, the rise of single-stream collection and the expansion of programs collecting paper to third-class mail, to office paper, to any kind of paper fiber that's available in a household. Where I live in Montgomery County, at the top of my head, the only paper I cannot put in my collection bin are pizza boxes that have got tomato sauce all over them. Maybe one or two other things, but it's really minor. I mean, I can put virtually any kind of paper into that bin, and it will be taken away.
Other comments?
Scott, this is Susan Collins. This is actually an issue that we've looked at, and I would tend to agree with Chaz. We have seen a correlation in the access to recycling rates as calculated by AFP&A. And we've plotted paper, different grades of paper, on the same chart, and the lines tend to move in tandem with each other. We've also done it for beverage containers, and the same relationship doesn't hold true. But we have found that as access to recycling, as defined by the AFP&A survey, as that increases, the paper commodities tend to increase almost in lockstep.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to go to a question here from Adam Page from EMC. And Adam asks, could focusing on weight mask the additional challenges presented by low-density materials? He says, I'm interested in the panelists' thoughts on whether the data they have been discussing should be considered in terms of volume as well as weight, especially considering that some of these materials are much less dense, for example, plastic foams, and the challenge of landfilling or economically processing large volumes of material. Is this kind of aggregate material volume data even available?
Scott, this is Scott Mal. I'll just sort of make a comment, I guess, about that. You know, I think the next wave of recyclables, you know, clearly are going to be you know, lower weight, higher volume materials, in particular cartons, aseptic containers, and non-bottle plastics. You know, that's one of the beauties of a cart system is that it allows that capacity for those voluminous materials. But in talking to MRFs in North Carolina and around the country and other folks, you know, clearly those are tough materials to justify a sort for within a MRF. You know, if you wanted to optically sort, aseptics and cartons, you have to have a very high volume of throughput through the entire MRF to really justify that sort from an economic perspective. And the same is true now as we see MRFs in our state, at least, and maybe other places, you know, trying to work through what it means to have, you know, number one, PET bales, number two, HDPE bales, and then this murky bale called 3 through 7s. And, you know, I think a lot of folks are trying to figure out, especially in the MRF world, how they manage that going forward and whether or not they can justify sorts, you know, within their own facility, or they can find a way to just, you know, to have the material sorted domestically and not send that material overseas. So, just by way of comment, it's going to be a big part of the challenge in packaging recovery. But I think the other point is that there's still a lot of traditional packaging materials, traditional meaning long recovered packaging materials, the mixed paper that Chaz talked about, glass bottles and jars, you know, again, that we're not getting. And there's still plenty of room for improvement along those lines.
Anyone else on the panel want to comment on that?
I do want to comment on the cost aspects of it. Thanks, Scott. We've looked at weight over time as an easy way to measure different types of waste in the material stream, and it's in some ways it's a relic of the past, using weight as our metric, given the conversations that we're having now. When we look at cost, especially for recycling, where the volume in the truck isn't as compacted as it is in a disposal truck, the biggest driver of cost of recycling is the collection side of it. That's about where 3/4 of the costs are. And the biggest driver of cost in a collection vehicle is the volume of the material, especially when you're trying not to compact the material too much so that you don't get clumping of the material and breakage of the material and that kind of thing. And so when I presented that slide that contained the cost data from the province of Ontario, the biggest way that those cost data are broken down are by density of material. So to directly answer the question, do we have density of these different material types? They certainly do in the Ontario system, and that data is available on the Internet. But they also use it to calculate cost of recycling the different materials, and that's why the less dense materials are so much more expensive to recycle.
So here's a follow-up question that's related to this. This is from Stephanie, I think it's Ong or Ong from Medtronic. And Stephanie asks, is there a good source of data that tells what material types, for example, different types of paper, plastic, foil pouches, et cetera, are universally recyclable and which can only be recycled in limited areas? Susan, do you know anything about that?
You know, for an individual wanting to recycle things, I usually refer them to the Earth 911 database.
Right.
Scott, if I could just make a comment about this, Scott Mao.
Sure.
You know, the other thing that's under development that I think we all need to look at closely, it's something that our state has endorsed as a dynamic mechanism for answering these kinds of questions and for helping move the ball forward, is the SPC label, which, you know, I think gives would do a number of things. Gives, you know, the public a clearer message. It drives a discussion between the public and, you know, the programs that serve them about what's recyclable and what's not. I think it would even induce a lot of brand owners and package manufacturers and others to become more involved in the recovery of their packaging. And it's not a developed system yet. It's been, you know, adopted in a very limited way, but by some pretty interesting, you know, array of folks. And I would encourage people to look at that SPC label as a way to eventually evolve toward a clear nationwide communication system for this exact question.
Let me offer those that are on the phone, also any of our participants, you know, feel free to jump in if you're working on any of these initiatives or you have additional suggestions to make. By all means, you know, jump in. You can push *6 on your line and state your name and affiliation, or you can continue to send emails to Stephanie and I, and we'll keep reading them as we're doing right now because these are excellent questions. let me just pause a second here to see if there's anyone that would like to jump in at this point. Okay, then I'm going to continue to ask the questions that keep coming in. So this is from Genevieve from EEQ in Quebec. And Genevieve asks, so this is for you, Susan. She says, Susan Collins gave some precisions about U.S. EPA data on recovery and recycling rates. For example, she said that in the recycling rate, contaminants are also included. And Susan, you made the point between, you know, the collection rate versus the actual recycling rate. So as Genevieve would like to know, is there some communication and exchange of information between U.S. EPA, local government, AmeriPen, and others to improve the accuracy and quality of this kind of data?
Well, I appreciate the question. Thanks, Scott. Thanks, Genevieve. But I don't want to speak for the US EPA. I will say that US EPA produces their report, their full report, every 2 years. They produce an abbreviated report every in the in-between years. And last year, in the August-September timeframe, they asked for public comment on that. So I would imagine that they received, you know, hundreds of comments, and that is their version of having a conversation about this. And I think they're in the process now of looking at that. And I think they're also in the process of looking at the work that BioCycle and Columbia University did. And they may make any number of changes in the coming years when they do their annual and every other year reports.
Scott, this is Chaz. I'd like to interject a comment. EPA gets the bulk of its recycling data from industry trade associations. I don't think, for instance, that AF&PA, when it reports newspaper recycling data, includes contaminants. I believe they simply report newspaper as recovered for recycling. The problem becomes with the exports. And that if you've ever seen any bales of mixed paper going overseas, you know they ain't 100% paper. They got all kinds of interesting stuff in them. And I think that's where the problem gets on some of the recycling rates, as you try to parse between what's handled in this country versus what's handled overseas. And I'd also raise some concerns over the BioCycle Columbia University data. It's a more accurate picture of the size of the solid waste universe. It's not necessarily a more accurate picture of the MSW universe, because the data sources that they use, which are disposal facilities, do not always accurately distinguish between whether sources are MSW or C&D or industrial non-hazardous. And you also get some interesting biases just to the nature of the industry. Every disposal facility in America gets more garbage for disposal or for collection on a day that it rains than on a day that does not rain. And that's a known fact in the industry, and there's any number of metrics to prove it in the industry. So you got to take some of this, all this data, with a grain of salt. There's flaws in everybody's data. Probably the most interesting study on the non-hazardous Subtitle D true universe was done by the Environmental Research and Education Foundation. It was done for them by R.W. Beck and a company called Chartwell over 10 years ago, and that estimated a total non-hazardous Subtitle D universe of somewhere in the area of 550 million tons, I think, is what it was. And to me, that's the more relevant number, because that's the true solid waste universe. It includes MSW, it includes C&D, it includes anything that's not hazardous.
Thanks. Let me just jump in and you know, ask this question. I mean, you point out, and Susan and others, that there's variation in data all the time. I mean, you know, we're just taking a snapshot at any one time. There's going to be contamination. If we've got markets in overseas or in China versus another place, there'll be varying degrees of contamination of the materials. And then the markets, if they're more domestic, they might have to be cleaner because of the different specifications. So there's going to be normal variations, if you will, in terms of the data. But how about in terms of big trends? Just if you're talking about this contamination issue, certainly there's been the single stream and dual stream issue. And I know that that has been a cause for a lot of discussion, whether or not the single stream, yes, the volume increases, but then so does some of the contamination and perhaps less recycling. At least this is what my impression is, what I'm hearing. But if you all the experts here, what have the trends been in contamination? Are they staying relatively the same, kind of up and down, fluctuating each year, or because of single stream and perhaps other types of changes, is the contamination getting greater over time?
Let me hazard a beginning comment. Contamination is kind of a relative term. Contamination only matters if the MRF does not catch it. And I think the biggest trend in recycling in the last two decades have been the technological innovations at materials recovery facilities. The difference between a MRF built in 1990 and a MRF built two decades later is night and day. The level of technological sophistication is the improvements are just absolutely astounding. So the first question is not the contamination at the curb, because whatever a MRF catches never gets included in recycling rates. That stuff gets landfilled or whatever. But the problem, I think, with single stream, for better or worse, and the problem with larger carts is it encourages erring on the wrong side, or as a relative of mine who shall not go named likes to say, they just throw it in the recycling bin and let the processor figure it out. And my members who are processors don't appreciate that, but it's a reality that we have to deal with. It's the flip side of larger bins and larger carts.
Scott, this is Dennis Sabora. May I weigh in on that?
Please. Yep, Dennis, you want to say where you're from?
Yes, Dennis Sabora from NAPCOR, National Association for PET Container Resources. Our focus, our centricity is PET containers, and very definitely contamination has increased over the last number of years. As a matter of fact, as part of our annual recycling rate report, we indicate what the contamination levels are. And how the contamination level is determined is through an annual bale characterization study, where we look at PET bales that would be sent to a reclaimer, go through the bale and identify what is a contaminant. And the contaminants are not necessarily things foreign to PET. They can be items that are PET, but yet have accoutrements on them that present recycling challenges. So very definitely, contamination has increased both because of the system, and as Chaz mentioned, single-stream recycling, but also marketing containers that are not adherent to the design for recyclability concept.
Dennis, could you get that's very interesting. Could you give some more examples of what you mean by accoutrements?
Repeat that again, please.
Yeah, this is Chaz. I think your comment is very interesting and very good. But what do you mean by the accoutrements?
Yeah, we're finding that the one we're fighting with today are full wrap labels.
Okay.
On PET containers, where we're working to get labels that are more recycling friendly, number one, and also working with systems that can see through a full wrap container to identify the substrate, the plastic substrate beneath. So we're making progress on that issue, but it's an issue that has grown over the last couple of years.
What's impelling the full wrap kinds of around the containers? Is that marketing or is it product?
Oh, yeah. It's a very, very attractive container. I mean, a full wrap container. And we want to make sure that the wrap that is used or the container, the label that is used, is compatible with existing recycling systems.
No, I think
otherwise, it's one away.
Absolutely.
Scott, this is Scott Mayo. If I can sort of address the contamination issue just real quickly. definitely, I think there's increased contamination. You know, we're hearing that from MRFs, and especially on the plastic side. I mean, Chaz is exactly right. I mean, people get these carts, and they are the most confused of all about the plastic stuff. And, you know, and there's all kinds of related issues around the resin identification code and all the communication that goes around trying to figure out how to train citizens on what to put in their cart when it comes to plastic. You just see people going through, you know, all kinds of communication gymnastics to try to figure that out. But I want to pose maybe a slightly controversial point, and that is, and as I've sort of seen how reclaimers have to deal with these materials and other folks as they come through the MRFs, I think to some degree the contamination problem is a function of a limited supply chasing a big demand. In other words, it's definitely a seller's market from the standpoint of a MRF. And I've seen this firsthand, you know, material come into reclamation facilities from MRFs that are, you know, really kind of unbelievable. But, you know, the reclamation facilities need the material, so they're willing to accept bales that only yield 70 or 75% material, and that would be on the upside oftentimes. So I think to some degree, you know, if there was more balance between supply and demand, you would have a higher premium on quality, and some of these contamination issues would at least be partially addressed.
Let me relay a comment here from Chip Foley from the Steel Recycling Institute, and I think this is apropos, and it's one of the comments I want to make and see if we're able to get our arms around it a little bit more. But, you know, because like, everyone's problems are different for them. You know, like, one person's problem is nothing for another. So Chip says here, contamination means different things to different materials. Our issues, the steel industry, their issues are for contamination are radioactivity and mercury. Just about everything else, including other materials, are not an issue. 2,800 degrees on a melt takes care of most issues. So I think that's, apropos here of the comment I want to make and get your response to it. And then after this, I'm gonna ask Ryan Modlin and perhaps Lynn Bragg, if she's on the phone, to talk about the congressional hearings that have been taking place recently in D.C. in the House subcommittee, looking at how to get better data on recycling. So I'm just going to hold off and kind of tee Ryan and Lynn up on that one. But, get a response from the panel if I can. You know, we've talked about each one of these. You know, there's so many different kinds of issues. Are there any of what we're calling kind of the problem here, the big problem, that is universal, that we all need to, you know, how do we make sense of all these little, or maybe they're not so little, how do, you know, these issues that are all wrapped up into the problem, are they on slide 21, where we're talking multifamily or, you know, single family and not getting enough materials from there? How do we get our arms around this so we're all sort of on the same page and not focused just on the issues that matter most to our product or our material?
Scott, I'll just put a comment out there to Scott Mao. I think, again, that one of the comments I made earlier is really critical, and that is the high variability in geographic situations around the country. You know, I think our friends in the Pacific Northwest, you know, would have different infrastructure and recovery problems than folks in the upper Midwest or here in the Southeast. And so, you know, one of the things we're really missing in terms of really figuring out what the true picture is as a country is this regional variation analysis. And if you were going to come into the Southeast and do an intervention of some kind to increase packaging recovery, I think you'd focus very heavily on the residential stream. If you were going to go into the Northeast, you probably would, you know, focus more on the commercial and non-residential or away-from-home stream. So it is really hard to disentangle this mess that we have with data, and especially as we start to look at it from a regional perspective. To some degree, we would all be served by a process, whether it's through EPA or somebody else, to look at data from a geographic perspective.
Scott, can I weigh in again, Dennis?
Just on this? Oh, I'm sorry. Was that a non-panelist participant that wanted to make a comment?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead, please.
you know, the I think one thing we need out of a data standpoint is a better idea of what away from home encompasses in terms of volume. Because, it's almost a Willie Sutton concept of, you know, why does he rob the bank? That's where the money is. I think we need to know where the materials are so we can then have resources dedicated to residential away from home and multifamily.
Is that Dennis from NAPCOR?
That was, yes.
Great. Thank you, Dennis.
Yeah, I think that's a good comment. I think in the scheme of things, I suspect that away from home pales in comparison to other generation sources. And I think the value of away from home is more symbolic. It's a reminder of the need to recycle, but it also has its own setbacks. I mean, I've been in a lot of airports, and I've seen a lot of well-meaning people try to recycle. And sometimes when you're in a hurry to catch a plane, you're not too careful. You're just trying to catch the plane. That away from home is plagued by even more human foibles than others. And I would step back to one thing that I think it's kind of nice that people are debating recycling some of the materials now and products that we're recycling, because it tells me that compared to what we were debating 20 years ago, we have come a long way. And we have the luxury to spread out and recycle more materials. I got a mailer at my house on Monday from my county about the collection program that the various haulers collect for recyclables. And unfortunately, I have not read the mailer carefully, but essentially they've expanded plastic to just virtually any kind of container. Part of the reason I haven't looked at it carefully is thanks to the energy loss of energy, I had to discard a lot of stuff in my refrigerator. So I'm mostly dealing right now with brand new packages that aren't ready to be recycled. But it's an expansion, and it's a much greater array of plastics that now I can put in my bin every week.
You're talking about the power outages down there in the D.C. Baltimore area, I take it.
Yes. Yes.
But let me ask you this, Chad. If we're looking at the big problems, it sounded like from your perspective, the away from home is more perceptual. Maybe it helps reinforce some of the recycling behavior that people will have at home, where it matters more. But where would you see the biggest gains that we've got in a sort of the big picture sense? Where should we all be focusing?
I think the hardest nuts to crack with the most potential are multifamily housing and multifamily commercial tenants. It's a very large subset, and it's very challenging to recycle in both locations.
Let me ask Susan, do you agree with that, or do you have a different perspective in terms of, the big picture? There's a lot of, as I was suggesting here, a lot of issues, around the different products and this, that, and it's very easy to get overwhelmed by all these, the data here. But if we step back, where do you see the biggest gains possible and therefore maybe the biggest problem?
Yeah, I absolutely do agree. I'll say a couple of things on that. Number one, I have had trouble trying to find it again, but I did read a study on away from home, and I think it's only 1% of the waste stream overall. If you're counting, if you're describing away from home as being places like airports and stadiums and bus stops, that kind of thing. It's visible, and for certain companies, doing away from home recycling represents a marketing opportunity. If you can have, if a company can sponsor and have their brand logo in a stadium, that's a marketing opportunity. But in terms of moving the needle on nationwide recycling rate, it's one of the smallest places we could go after. I agree with what Chaz said about the commercial sector, especially the multi-tenant. The smaller businesses, not the enormous, huge ones that can afford roll-off service because they've got so much material. And multifamily. Multifamily is just a perennial struggle. Even in places where it's been tried over and over, Jen talked about turnover rates in population, and that's even more so in the multifamily sector. The last thing, though, about the what is the big opportunity is to reemphasize that this problem is really complex. So none of us are going to come up with a single sound bite and say, this is your answer, this is your silver bullet. All of the things that were potentially silver bullets have already been done. The rest of it is going to be that much harder because it's that much more complex.
Oh, come on, Susan. I think people were checking in on this call to get the answer. I'm joking, of course. Joanne, you've been working with AmeriPen, and you have some very astute consultants working with you as well in trying to tackle this problem. And you've put out a knowledge map and some of the other initiatives that you're working on. Have you been able to yet characterize sort of what the big problem is, or some of the big areas that you think we have the biggest potential for gains?
Well, yes, I think that's when you take a look at the knowledge map, and if you recall, there was that one tab called Summary Profile. I think from that information, you know, we have determined what we think to be the biggest opportunities for improvement are. But to be honest, Scott, I thought that was going to be the second or third call. I mean, I think the biggest opportunity, and Scott Mao can jump in because he was a big contributor to this, is really increasing curbside.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll go ahead and weigh in on that. You know, so that there are definitely opportunities across the country to optimize curbside recycling. Again, you know, geography really matters. I mean, you have large cities in the Midwest that don't even have curbside yet. You have lots of underperforming programs in Florida and in different parts of the country and Southeast and other places where curbside recycling is clearly a piece of low-hanging fruit hanging in front of us. If we were going to, as a group of folks, you know, figure out where to optimize recycling, I think we'd have to look at the underserved or the non-served residences across the country, and that would point us to certain geographic areas. You know, if we were going to look at other sectors of the country, we'd have a different challenge on our hands, and we'd have to figure out how to introduce, recycling. Like, for example, as Chaz was talking about, the multifamily sector in Maryland, or as they've now done in California. So you see now states putting in laws to drive that next piece of infrastructure, whether we like those laws or not. I mean, you know, it's a representation of where people think the next, the next point of action needs to be. And just a kind of fine point on away from home, I think away from home to me has always been sort of non-residential. So I always think of commercial as being away from home. You're not at home when you're, generating your office paper or your can in the cafeteria. And, I think that's a point we probably need to think through in terms of how we're characterizing things, and maybe we need to categorize things differently. But, to sort of Chaz's point and Susan's point, there is a huge amount of opportunity there as well.
Scott, let me ask a question, if you don't mind. You may not want to mention cities that don't have programs or need improvement, but what kind of overall national tonnage or percentage gain do you see out of single-family residential?
Well, this is a point that I was making earlier. We don't really have great data on this, right? So I'll just reflect on North Carolina's experience. Again, we use these benchmarks, and it would be very helpful if we had a benchmark for the country as a whole, how much recyclable material is in a given household. Again, you know, my best guess is 750 pounds or 800 pounds per household. And we can do the math from there because we would know the number of households from the census. Figure that out. What we don't have is the numerator. We really don't have a national data set that tells us how much residential material we are collecting. But to some degree, you could do that work on a state-by-state basis and come up with it. The hard part of this whole exercise is, you know, the amount of really kind of grassroots level work that needs to be done to increase recycling. If you're paying attention to the news that comes through, you know, different recycling newsletters, you'll have seen recently that St. Petersburg, Florida, a decent-sized city, canceled its program because they couldn't get enough subscriptions. You know, Tampa reported a 30% recycling rate. There was a story last week or the week before about how Boston is really behind in its recycling rates compared to other other cities of its size. Somebody mentioned the other day that Columbus, Ohio is a city of major size that doesn't have curbside recycling. I don't think Indianapolis
has it. Actually,
that's not
correct. Columbus just started its curbside program, and it's taken off very well. It's a new program.
That's an indicator that there are big chunks of cities out there that are ready to go, and so that's the hard part, figuring out where that material is.
Well, we
don't have that national data set.
But that might be an indicator that most cities, in fact, do have a program. Some have better programs than others, and we need to focus on the ones that don't have the better programs.
Right.
Best practices. Let me just say and thank you for Kevin Dietley sending in some information here, looking at away from home recycling, and we're going to if this is okay with Kevin, we can post this on the password protected website that all of you have access to. Sago Jackson from Snohomish County has also sent us some information about multifamily, some other thing. I'm trying to read cross-contamination issues around that issue. So if we're able to post additional information, if people would like to send that to Stephanie or myself, we can post that information and add to the discussion here. Before we get further in, I did say that I was going to turn over to Ryan Modlin, and also Ryan Modlin's from Owens, Illinois, and Lynn Bragg from the Glass Packaging Institute. I know that Lynn testified in Congress at one of the House subcommittees on this very issue of recycling data, as did Maddie Stanislaus, the Assistant Administrator for EPA, and a number of others from the paper industry, the aluminum industry, and others as well. Let me ask, Lynn or Ryan, are you with us? You have to push *6 to unmute your line. If you're with us, *6
yep,
will unmute.
Yep, it's Ryan.
There you go. Hi, Ryan.
Two.
I forgot to hit *6.
And Lynn is Ryan. Lynn is with us as well. One of you or both of you give us a little background in terms of the legislation that's being developed? I understand it hasn't been introduced yet, but it is specifically on this point about getting better recycling data.
That's
thanks,
correct.
Scott. Yes, it is, and The legislation developed or has been developed out of a lot of conversations with a lot of groups, a lot of people, and Chaz has been involved. There's some people on this call who's been involved. And this conversation's been really, really, really helpful because it's very similar to many conversations that we're having in terms of where this bill is going. So coming out of the EPA stakeholder dialogue last year, a couple of us got together and said, "Well, if data is the issue, why don't we do something to either help the EPA modernize and enhance the way that data is collected, or the states, or figure out some way where we can reduce and close the gaps in the data, and then highlight the problem and come up with potential solutions instead of just tag it with somebody to take on and hope for the best result." So the idea is to get everybody involved and modernize the way data is used and collected. The different recycling rates that are part of your presentation tell a story best, and there's such a gap. And if you go through the recent MSW report, the gaps between what the Franklin Associates report shows on a state level versus what the state level reports, and there are many states with 10-plus percentage point difference, and I like highlighting California because we've got three plants in California, and so we're very involved with the recycling rate there. And the EPA recycle rate is 62%, but according to the state report, it's already at 75%. And according to Carol Mortensen, the Cal Recycle Director, they have a project to get to 75%, and she said that number is not correct. So, data is essential. So The bill, it's not a silver bullet. All we're looking to do is get everyone together and say, if data is going to be improved, how do we do it? Let's get everybody of interest, paper, plastic, aluminum, glass, the haulers, the MRF operators, everybody involved, and come up with the first step. And you know, we as a glass company, we can speak from the glass perspective, but we certainly don't pretend to speak for the other commodities. That's why the conversation has been so helpful. I think we've received a very, very good response from the Hill, both Republicans and Democrats, when presented with data from their states or some municipalities or reports from Ameripan or CRI, et cetera. The facts are telling. And we had one local congressman tour our facility a couple months ago, and he was very, very delighted to hear our plant manager say, we need more recycled material. He said, well, my wife and I drive 50 miles round trip to our city or locality where they have a recycling center, and we take three blue bins full of stuff to recycle, so you must be getting our glass. And then our next slide pretty much was, ding, we get 0% out of that municipality and state, even though you're driving 50 miles round trip. So that was an eye-opener to that legislator. And we've repeated that many times over, and people are really surprised that when they put the blue bin out or when they take a container to a recycling center, that it may not be recycled. And just using the EPA data, when it's 12%, 20%, 30%, people are shocked that it's not better than 80% because they each have a story to tell, whether they're walking on the mall or at their house or at the airport, as Chaz points out, that when they put it in a recycling bin, they expect it to be recycled. So that's the bill. Lynn testified. She can speak to that point. But, again, this is the first step, and we're hopeful that people will find it useful because we hope that this conversation continues over the next couple of years. Thanks, Scott.
Now, thank you very much, Ryan. And sorry, there's some background noise that if anyone's got the background noise there, push *6 to mute your line, please. And Lynn, I know you were trying to speak before, and I'd like you to add to what Ryan had mentioned.
Sure. Thank you. This is Lynn Bragg, and I'm president of BPI. And yes, I did testify at the hearing a couple of weeks ago, I guess about a week and a half ago. And I thought in general terms, the hearing was very well attended from both sides of the members. And the questions that the members asked were along the lines of would this bill give more authority to EPA, to the Environmental Protection Agency, which we assured them that it would not, that they already had the authority. They asked about, how does this fit in with, with jobs, why is it important to the glass industry? So I, made sure to make that point in terms of energy emission reductions and cost savings and the ability to keep, high-paying salary and hourly jobs in the United States and in many of their states. And, basically went over with them what we were looking for in the bill, which is pretty much what Ryan has already said, and that is trying to figure out what's in that black hole between the collection of the recyclable materials and the return of the materials to manufacturers. And as each of the industries testified, there was a lot of head nodding on the part of the members in terms of, understanding. It's like they were all thinking, well, I take my recyclables out to the curb in my blue bin, and I just assume that the material is being recycled. So I think there was a high level of understanding there on the part of the subcommittee members, and there is a high level of interest in this legislation. So we hope that it will keep moving forward.
Great. Thank you very much, Lynn and Ryan. And for those that are on the call that have not seen it, we did post a copy of this bill. Let me just ask, Lynn, is the appropriation that you're looking for, can you tell me what the appropriation is that you'd be looking for this bill?
Well, this bill doesn't really have any appropriate. It's not an appropriations bill. It's a piece of legislation authorizing EPA to be able to one, collect information from various groups that are more than nine in number. They're prevented right now because of the a jot and tittle under the Paperwork Reduction Act from going to groups more than nine. So one, it would allow them to do that, and two, there was already, I believe, and correct me, Ryan, if I'm wrong, some authorizing language already included in the report language concerning appropriations.
Yeah, that's correct, Lynn. And so last year's appropriations bill, we had inserted some language that came up during the hearing that the EPA was supposed to have a report back to Congress on recycling rates, basically. And they're, according to the chairman's office, they're still waiting to hear back from the EPA on that. And we're hopeful that that is forthcoming. I believe it is. I think Maddie said during the hearing that they were working on it. But in terms of this bill, so when we met with EPA staff, who were very helpful, and I think if I heard it right from the folks that we met with, that they would welcome this type of effort because the current budget is right around $70,000 to look at various recycling categories and recycling recovery systems around the country, which is part of the problem. So we went to staff and said, okay, this needs to be expanded. Committee staff's still playing around with the final number, Scott. But we're hoping even if it's expanded to $500,000, that the one-time report that we're asking for is modernized, updated, or better than a product that is currently out there, and that we could work closely with the EPA. We, as in people on this call, commodities, states, whatever, to figure out what works, where things are going. If your recycling rate is 21% in the state, but there's a high differential of what's collected and what's sold, as Scott Mao's slide shows quite well. There's a huge difference in what is collected and recycled. Why is that? And I think there needs to be modern data points attached or utilized. What they are, I don't know, because those would come out in conversations with the experts, those people on the call. But it's also important to remember that, again, there's groups out there like CRI, Ameripen, PACNEXT, who are all looking at these same questions and the need for the same type of data. So my hope is that we could move this thing or move this concept in an effort to make what we're trying to get at easier and better down the road. And if, as a manufacturer, this is an energy intensity, energy efficiency item for us. And we're very interested. And I know there's other commodities and brand owners who have the same interest. We're very, very excited about this opportunity.
Great. Well, I want to thank you, you and Lynn, also for being with us and conveying that information. Unfortunately, we're going to have to now wind up this call. I know it's been a long one for many of you. We usually run our calls an hour and a half, but this one was 2 hours, and at least to me, it seemed like it was a blink of the eye. When you're talking about these kind of complex issues, we can go on and on. And the key is, how do we bring this into a landing? How do we make sense of it? How do we not get bogged down in all the details, left or right, or little bits, but how can we as a group, all of us, move together? And Ryan, your comment about all the different groups looking for better data and how to get them on the same page is very appropriate. And hopefully we've been able to do a little bit of that here. Let me turn your attention, as we're winding up here, back to the slides. I wanted to continue our discussion, so I did not draw our attention to slide 45, which is the opportunity statement and the project focus. But what I'd like you to do, if those of you can take a look at this now, read it, this one paragraph, and I'm not going to take the time right now to do so, but it's a a problem and opportunity statement wrapped up in one, and kind of along the lines of what we're talking about here, and respond, if you will. Send me some comments, Stephanie some comments, to get a sense, is this in the right ballpark? Is it not in the ballpark? What's it missing? How does it mischaracterize anything? So please respond to this, as well as the project focus. If we were looking at the packaging and printed materials, is that the right focus? Or is it, as Susan was saying, you know, you've got Europe mostly focused on packaging. You got Canada packaging and printed materials. We've got households, businesses, institutions, away from home. Is this the way the lens that we should be looking at, or is it something different? So if you could just comment on this one slide, we'd appreciate it, and we'll feed back the comments to all of you. And then lastly, here on slide 46, in 2 weeks, July 25th, again, two-hour call, we will have 5 representatives from the commodity industry, 2 government officials, to talk about publicly stated goals, how they arrived at their goals, how they plan to achieve those goals, and then any barriers that each group perceives in preventing it from being successful in reaching those goals. And again, we're looking at how the public and private goals go together, what the barriers are, and just to see where we're at right now, where these companies and agencies want to get to, and then, you know, again, looking at some of the stuff we're talking about here, where are they going to get this material from? You know, if you're at 20%, you need to get to 40% recycling, how are you going to get there, and what are the barriers to achieving that? So on slide 47, you'll see those that are going to be speaking. Ryan, who was with us here from Owens, Illinois, Beth Schmidt from Alcoa, Kathy Foley from AF&PA, Elizabeth Comer from Tetra Pak, Jim Wood from the Steel Recycling Institute, and Steve Nevado from Association of Post-Consumer Plastic Recyclers, and then we'll have Garth Hickel and Bill Smith from government agencies. So with that, I want to thank all of our speakers today, panelists, and all those that have sent in your excellent comments and questions, and I hope that this was a useful call for you. I know it's just, again, a tip of the iceberg, but I hope that you learned something new and we can follow up in the future. We'll be sending out an evaluation. You can give us your feedback. And with that, I want to say thank you very much and have a good rest of the day and a good rest of the week. Take care. Bye-bye.